New polling from UNF this week shows a mixed bag for Governor Rick Scott as he ponders his political future. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download our WJCT app and listen anytime. You can also listen to the show right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, why a new poll says Senator Bill Nelson leads Governor Scott in a hypothetical matchup next year. Get on the line now. Let us know who you'd like to see leading the state, 549-2937. Then later, we've got to look ahead to this area's 9th annual Autism Symposium. Plus, it's Women's History Month. We'll tell you about the 120th anniversary of the National League of American Pen Women, all of that ahead. But first this hour, good news for Florida Senator Bill Nelson, the long-serving Democrat and former astronaut, polling very well in a hypothetical matchup for his Senate seat against Governor Rick Scott. Now, Scott is widely assumed to be eyeing that race next year when he leaves the governor's mansion due to term limits, and Nelson faces re-election. Right now, according to the numbers, Nelson holds a 6-point lead over Scott among the state's registered voters. There's much more to share in the numbers. Dr. Mike Binder runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab and joins us now in studio. Mike, good to see you.
Good to see you again. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Who would get your vote in a hypothetical matchup next year between Senator Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. So you put another poll out this week showing that 44% of the state's registered voters would vote to reelect Senator Nelson. Just 38% say in that race they'd choose Governor Rick Scott, a 6-point lead for Nelson.
Yeah, and those are great numbers for Nelson, considering he's been getting a little bit of grief for being quiet and staying out of the limelight when he has reelection coming up. And also considering that Rick Scott has been in the forefront. He was a big face in Donald Trump's election back in the fall, and he's gearing up for a very active Florida state legislative session that begins later today.
And now these are only registered voters you polled, not all likely voters.
Correct. And there's a difference between registered voters and likely voters, especially during a midterm election. The midterm voters tend to be older, tend to be a little bit more Republican, and then they also tend to be a little bit whiter. All of those things tend to lean toward favoring a Rick Scott.
That would favor Rick Scott. At the same time, as you look at the nuances in this polling, even though Donald Trump won Florida in the presidential election, you find a majority of Florida's registered voters disapprove of Trump. How do you see that helping Bill Nelson possibly against the governor if they go head to head for that open Senate seat?
Well, obviously, Rick Scott is very much connected to Donald Trump. He was very supportive of him, and he's been up to D.C. a couple times. He's seen him since he's been down here regularly in Florida, the president, that is. So I think as Donald Trump goes, I think that's certainly going to either help or hinder Rick Scott. And with President Trump, who knows? Any day is a different day. Anything can happen. And the fact that we're 19 months out, we still have some time yet.
It's 549-2937. Who would get your vote next year as politicians put their names up for election in the midterms of 2018? Right now, according to UNF's polls, Senator Bill Nelson would beat Governor Rick Scott for that open Senate seat. Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, you also find that a majority of Florida's registered voters disapprove of the president's travel ban executive order. The Trump administration has put out a new ban that they'd like to institute, a sort of a travel ban 2.0. It allows green card holders and visa holders to travel freely. There are fewer countries on this list. At the same time, it remains controversial. How do you see that affecting the state's politics?
Well, again, this is one of those many issues that Donald Trump has put his name on that has brought a ton of controversy to the discussion. And this second version of the travel ban is a little less problematic legally because of existing visa holders and green card holders being exempt from this. It also gives some time to the State Department and ICE and Customs to put this stuff together and figure out how it's going to actually be implemented. But you still have that same concern. And if there's really a problem with our visa and our refugee vetting systems, why isn't a country like Saudi Arabia on this? And if the concern is, well, it's the countries where we don't know who these people are. Well, why aren't places like North Korea on this? So these are, you know, what about Pakistan, Afghanistan? So that's what I think is leading to some of the controversy and some of the concern.
Also, let me ask you about this. After Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, mobilized, organized opposition to his agenda sprung up in the form of Tea Party groups all over the country. They flooded town halls protesting passage of the Affordable Care Act. They organized at the grassroots level, and they were successful in slow rolling a lot of President Obama's agenda. Now we're seeing almost a mirror image of that with liberal leading groups under the banner Indivisible, organizing, flooding town halls, demanding that representatives, congressmen and senators, not repeal the Affordable Care Act, demanding a whole array of things opposed to President Trump's agenda. Do you see the same level of anger and opposition on the other side this time around? And will that drive turnout in the midterm elections? Because typically, off year elections, you don't see, as you said, younger, more Democratic-leaning voters turn out to the same degree as older, more conservative voters do.
All true. I think the answer is it's yet to be seen. I'm skeptical about the turnout increases, mostly because it's still so far away and a lot of things can happen and people can become apathetic over time. You know, it's very exciting. Trump is in the news. He's ginning up anger. But is he still doing that 18 months from now? Very well, very possible. We don't know is the short answer. And, you know, what happened with the Tea Party in 2010 and the mobilization at the grassroots level, you're seeing a lot of that on the left. But oftentimes, if you look back over history, this type of thing happens when you have unified government, particularly in a circumstance when there's high polarization. And we have that here. So people feel like their voice isn't being heard, so they're doing what they can to have their voice heard if they're not seeing their elected representatives put up the policies that they want to see.
A few more data points in Mike's poll. For all the controversy around transgender rights, 62% of registered Florida voters say they have no problem with a transgender individual using the bathroom of the facilities they identify with. The majority of voters don't want concealed handguns on college campuses. And the majority of Florida registered voters, a slim majority, oppose allowing licensed individuals to openly carry a handgun in the state. Some interesting findings there.
Yeah, there's a series of interesting findings. And you know, the guns got a lot of attention last week with the Supreme Court's decision about open carry. But ironically, we asked another question about limiting assault weapon sales and high-capacity magazines. And there was opposition to changing that as well. So it looked like Floridians are very much on the status quo fence when it comes to gun rights. You don't want to expand them necessarily, but they're not looking to reduce them either. And I think the transgender issue brought up, we dealt with this most recently with the HRO here locally. How does that play out at the state level? And I think, you know, people are people is really what Floridians are saying.
All right, let's go to your calls right now for UNF pollster Mike Binder. Who would get your vote in a hypothetical Senate race next year between sitting Senator Bill Nelson and Florida Governor Rick Scott? 549-2937. Laura in Mandarin. Hey, Laura, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Long-time listener.
Oh, thanks.
I remember watching Rick Scott debate against Alex Sink and feeling so disappointed that the fraudulent allegations against him weren't really recognized. And I feel like if someone really wants to move forward, like you said, the apathy could be an issue. If people don't support this in a midterm, then we're going to be stuck in the same situation as the presidential election. So I'm 100% for Bill Nelson, and I'll take my response off the air.
And one thing to be considered, and this is always true in politics, and we talked about some of the approval numbers, Trump's approval, disapproval numbers were high, as were Rubio's. But Rubio just won re-election. Yeah. Trump just won election. Something to think about is who you are running against. And there's arguments to be made that the two candidates the Democrats put up against Rick Scott were not the strongest. Bill Nelson is a tested, strong candidate that's won election statewide multiple times. Yeah. So Rick Scott's up against it.
Bill Nelson is just about the only so-called Dixiecrat in the country left standing. He is a conservative, southern, old-school Democrat of the type you rarely see anymore.
Which is something that could help him with that midterm electorate that's been around for a little while, that feels like they know and trust him. Now, where that might cause a problem for him, and he's seeing some murmurs, is on his left flank. Might he see a primary challenge?
Right.
And how might that play out in a particularly low turnout election in August of a midterm year?
And that speaks to this extreme polarization you mentioned a minute ago. Both parties are increasingly being pulled to the margins by their most extreme flanks. There aren't a lot of centrists left like Nelson at the national level.
Right. And part of that's because of the way our election systems are set up. Even at the statewide level, you see less of it than at the House level because the districts are so homogenous. But at the statewide level, because candidates are determined in primaries and the people that show up in primaries tend to be the most invested and care the most, and those folks tend to be the most out on the extremes, they tend to elect candidates. And you saw this in 2010 with the Republicans. They elected a lot of candidates, even with that excitement, that Tea Party motivation. They elected a lot of candidates that were too far extreme to win, and they lost a lot of elections in 2010 that they could have won.
We are talking politics on the show right now with UNF pollster Mike Binder, 549-2937 to join us. Let's go to Roger in St. Augustine now. Hey, Roger. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. I am definitely going to vote for Bill Nelson. I think he has done a wonderful job as a senator, and I think we will need that kind of stability in Washington.
All right. Thanks for your opinion, Roger.
Yeah, and there's a lot of Nelson supporters out there, obviously. Our poll shows that. I will say one thing. If the economy holds firm and unemployment's hanging out around or below 5%, and Rick Scott ran on two statewide elections on three issues, jobs, and more jobs, and he can point to that and say, listen, I've delivered on the economy, and the economy is always an important issue. That's something to be wary of.
549-2937, Patricia along I-95. Hey, Patricia, I hope your drive's going all right. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hey, go ahead.
I'm going to have to say I've been a registered Democrat all my life, but in this election, if this hypothetical election were to develop, I would vote for Rick Scott. I feel that Senator Nelson is a fine fella and has done real well, but I kind of like him to stay in Washington. And I think that Governor Scott has put the business interests of the state in the forefront, which translates to working people.
Okay. Yeah. So you'll vote for Scott over Nelson. That would actually take Nelson out of Washington.
Yeah.
He'd be retired.
And it would send Rick Scott to Washington.
It would send Rick Scott to Washington. But you like the governor, Patricia?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, and there's a lot of folks like that, and you know, speaks to it. You know, the economy's been great, and much like a football team, the quarterback gets credit, even though it might be the defense that's winning the games.
All
and
right.
And so that's something to think about.
Lots of calls. Stevie in Murray Hill. Hey, Stevie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was fortunate enough to meet Bill Nelson when my friends and I went to the Women's March in D.C. in January. And we went to the breakfast that was hosted by Debbie Wasserman Schultz for the Florida delegation going to the march. And, of course, it was super exciting, and there were tons of us there. And, you know, Bill Nelson showed up and gave a really lovely talk. And I was just kind of impressed that he, as you mentioned before, you know, he's a centrist and a Dixiecrat. And I just appreciated that he showed up and made a statement on such an important day and didn't shy away from activism and what was going on. And I know it's, you know, it could be seen as pandering for votes, but I was really happy to see him there. And I appreciate the fact that he's a little more centrist. And so I'll be voting for him.
All right. Thanks for that call.
And this goes to speak a lot to who Bill Nelson is as a person and a politician. You know, by all accounts, the man's a good guy, and not a lot of folks have bad things to say about him as a human being, unlike maybe some of our national candidates lately. So I think that helps him. But also, he is a consummate senator. You know, he does those types of things. He appears, he shows up, he goes to events. It's hard work, and he puts himself out there on issues that he thinks are important.
Here's a tweet for you. Ask Mike Bender to name two or three positive things Scott can take credit for. How is Florida better for his leadership compared to Nelson? As you said a minute ago, Mike, of course, it's expected Governor Scott will run on his economic record.
Yeah, I mean, he's run on that twice now and been successful. And listen, you know, the economy's good. Jobs are up. It's not entirely his fault, but certainly if you're the leader, you get credit for that to some extent. He has been very pro-business. He's fighting that with right now with the Visit Florida fight and the Enterprise Florida fight. He's looking out for small businesses, maybe unlike some other candidates might have done. So I think if you care about the economy and you care about business and you're less concerned about regulations and the environment and things of that nature, maybe Rick Scott's your guy.
By the way, the new UNF poll finds the state's voters think education, healthcare, and crime are the most important issues facing the state. Just 10% say the environment is the most important problem. However, the majority of voters think the state should spend more resources on protecting the environment. So that's kind of interesting.
Right. And this is one thing, and it's very timely, even at the national level, with Trump's budget plan to slash the EPA. And this is something that literally the EPA director under Reagan and Nixon even came out and was saying, listen, the American people, they like the environment clean. We don't want to be Beijing. And that's something to keep in mind. Also, this is Florida. You know, we have a huge tourism industry, lots of jobs, lots of money. And if our beaches are brown and our lakes you can't swim in or fish in, who's going to come here?
Well, if you're just tuning in, a new poll from UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab finds Bill Nelson in good shape heading into reelection if his opponent is Governor Rick Scott. That could be the scenario. Nelson leads Scott currently among the state's registered voters by 6 points. Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning to y'all, too. I just wanted to echo a point that A.G. Gankarski made with the congressional election, that we are really running the risk of losing Capitol Hill. And I fear that's more than likely, because the same voters that didn't turn out to support Hillary will probably not turn out to support Bill Nelson.
Thank you for that, Tom. And Mike Bender, as you said, we're a year and a half out, but turnout is always the key in these in these off-year elections.
Especially in a state like Florida, where these statewide races are always very, very close. I think Bill Nelson is better positioned than Hillary Clinton, because Hillary and Clinton engendered so much anger, and there was a much more problems with her personal life and also her credibility issues. Bill Nelson doesn't have any of those. He's also been elected here multiple times. But the caller's right. This is not going to be an easy race for Bill Nelson. If Rick Scott runs, he's up against a formidable candidate. Nelson's going to probably have a challenge in the primary that he'll have to win. I would imagine he'd win it, but it might pull him to the left a little bit. So there's a lot of things that could happen between now and next November.
Here's a tweet for you from Adam. Have your polling methods changed post 2016 election and the 2016 disconnect between the polls and what we saw on election night in terms of the results?
Sure.
Has that changed your methodology?
It's changed our methodology only to the sense that we try even more so to be more transparent about our methods. And that's the best that we can do. We make efforts for when it comes to election predictions. We use voter lists and things of that nature to really narrow down and make sure we're getting the people that are showing up. But even with the polling that we did, yeah, we were off. We had Hillary Clinton up by a couple points on our last survey, but that came out literally the day before Comey's announcement, the week and a half before the election. So, you know, things happen in those last couple of weeks that might change the tide and might bring a few votes. And really, you know, a percentage point or two is really all that can make the difference here in a state like Florida.
Thanks, as always, for the interesting numbers. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Dr. Mike Bender runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Laboratory. Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, the power of women. A couple of local events mark Women's History Month. We'll have details on that. But up next, important information for parents, doctors, and teachers at this week's Autism Symposium. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, President Trump accused President Obama of spying on his campaign. We don't know if that's true, but a secret court order was approved last year targeting Trump's associates.
It means there was some basis to believe that somebody may have been acting as an agent of the Russians.
The president's war with the intelligence community, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Should schools be required to offer recess? Does Florida need new fracking regulations? These and other important questions are up for debate in this year's legislative session. WJCT and public radio stations across Florida are teaming up for coverage of hot topics expected to make news. Hear these stories during Morning Edition. Decision Florida coverage next week here on 89.9 WJCT.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor, Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, this area's 9th Annual Autism Symposium is set for tomorrow on the UNF campus. Presented by Wolfson Children's Hospital, UF Health Jacks, and Nemours Children's Specialty Care, this is an important look at current medical evidence and interventions around autism. It's now estimated some 1 in 68 children are affected by an autism spectrum disorder. Kids with autism tend to be male, and they often have difficulty with social interaction and communication, among other issues. But the earlier the diagnosis, the better hope for interventions that can really make a difference. We've got a preview now as we welcome two experts in the field, Dr. Peter Zatmari. He's chief of the Child and Youth Mental Health Collaborative at the Hospital for Sick Children and Center for Addiction and Mental Health at the University of Toronto. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Also in studio, Dr. Peter Mundy, Associate Dean for Academic Personnel and Research, School of Education, and Director of Educational Research at UC Davis Mind Institute. Doctor, good to see you.
Good morning.
And you know, every year, the Autism Symposium brings world-renowned experts in autism spectrum disorders here to Jacksonville. So gratifying to have you both here in studio to share the latest on this with us. Dr. Zatmari, let's begin with you. You're going to be giving a talk tomorrow called The Meaning of Sex Differences in Autism Spectrum Disorders and Other Neurodevelopmental Disorders. So we know that overwhelmingly children on the autism spectrum are boys. Why is that? And what is the research showing as to why we see this so much more often in male children as opposed to girls?
Well, Mark Twain said that everybody talks about the weather, but nobody can predict it
right,
or understand it. Same thing with sex differences. Everybody knows that the sex difference is four boys roughly to every girl in autism spectrum disorder, but understanding why that is and what it means is still very much a mystery. I'll say a couple of things. First of all, it's probably not 4-1. I think
4-1 male to female.
Yeah, 4-1 male to female. I think it's more equal. I think we're missing a lot of girls with ASD.
Oh, really? Why do you think that?
Because I don't think we really understand what girls with ASD look like. I think our measurement tools and our understanding of what the disorder is very male biased. And if we had a more, you know, informed, gender-informed perspective of what the condition looks like in girls, we'd be identifying more girls. And I'm talking in particular, I think we miss a lot of girls who sort of have typical cognitive abilities, but they look like they have anxiety disorders, they look like they have learning disabilities, and they're not as obvious, as it were, as boys. So I think we're missing a lot of girls.
Interesting.
I still think there's a male bias, but it's not as big as 4-1. It's maybe more like 2-1.
2-1. And yeah. And what are your questions about the newest research around autism spectrum disorders? The 9th Annual Autism Symposium is tomorrow on the UNF campus. It's 549-2937 to join us. Okay, so even if the sex ratio isn't as stark as is thought, is there still any research to show that perhaps hormones are playing a part, that there's a female protective effect, protecting more girl children from being affected by an autism spectrum disorder, estrogen versus testosterone?
Yeah, so there are several different theories as to what the cause of this female protective effect is. What is it that protects girls from developing the disorder? Hormones is one. There are other explanations. Genes, for example, are a really important part of the etiology of the disorder, and we know that genes are expressed differently in boys and girls, and it may well be that the genes that are expressed differentially are really important in the etiology of the disorder. That's another explanation. Another explanation is it's not such a big deal. Girls have better social skills. Girls have better language, you know, in typically developing kids, and maybe it's that normal developmental effects that actually protects girls. Whatever it is,
that they could be on the spectrum, but it's just not as obvious because they tend to be more socially skilled.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's certainly true with my daughters. But you know what? It's really important to understand what it is that protects girls, because that could lead us to a whole new range of interventions that we've never thought of before. We were so focused on what are the risk factors that cause the disorder, and so much less so on what protects girls. But actually, in terms of interventions, understanding that may be really important.
All right. And there's so much to discuss here. As we talk about those interventions, let's bring Dr. Peter Munday into the conversation. Now, you'll be discussing the role of joint attention in autism. What is joint attention?
It's a very technical sounding term, isn't it? Joint attention.
Yeah. So, do I need to give more attention to my joints? They are getting a little sore these days now. No, I kid. What is it all about?
Well, when we're growing up as infants, we have to be able to benefit from our parents trying to instruct us. The only way that we human beings can enter into instructional interactions with other people is if we can pay attention to what the instructor is trying to get us to attend to. And so joint attention is a basic human ability that develops in the first 6 months of life and keeps expanding. And it allows children to pay attention to what another person is attending to have a common perspective. And that's necessary for language development. It's necessary for a lot of different types of cognitive development. But most importantly, it's necessary to be able to learn from instruction. And that's one of the problems for people affected by autism, is that they have difficulty benefiting from instruction from others.
They have such a difficult time with sensory integration and stimulation and getting information from a variety of different sources at once?
It is, although the sensory integration and the distraction is a little bit different than the joint attention.
Okay.
Joint attention relates a little bit to the sex differences. So in typical development, it takes boys a lot longer to become entrained to pay attention to what their caregiver wants to pay attention to. Girls do that much more rapidly early in life. So for boys, they're just more vulnerable to this problem.
And how is that impacting then the types of interventions that are being developed for kids?
Well, interventions have gone through at least two or three phases. For one thing, we now know that intervention works for young children with autism, or at least many young children with autism. We started off with behavioral interventions, but now we've come to the understanding that since children with autism have a hard time paying attention to what other people are attending to, one of the best ways to intervene is to figure out what the child with autism is paying attention to and try to deliver learning trials in conjunction with what they're attending to.
Now, in keeping with that, along with another physician, you founded the RAD Center. That's the Reading and Academic Development Center. This is a center that's developing different intervention methods for kids on the spectrum. How can you tell us a little bit about that?
So we've been very good over the last three decades in understanding how to intervene with preschool children with autism. We haven't done such a good job with understanding how to leverage what children are doing in school from kindergarten through 12th grade in a way that optimizes their development. And the basic idea here is that children with autism are affected by a social communication problem. What happens in terms of social communication development when you enter school is you go into a new phase, learning to read. And it turns out that many children with autism, although they can read words well, have difficulty with reading comprehension.
Let's go to a few calls now about this week's Autism Symposium on the UNF campus. Nat along University Boulevard. Hi, Nat. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So good. I'm going to sound like an idiot here, but I was just at Voyage Chiropractic, and it's a very interesting method that they're using for helping out with different chronic diseases, and that's just making sure that your spine is aligned so you're getting all the correct transmissions from point A to point B. And I'm just curious, you know, this being a symposium of, you know, research and trying to figure stuff out, if you guys have looked at the spinal cord or any of that. And I'm trying so hard not to sound like an idiot.
That's all right, Nat. No, thank you for the question. Dr. Satmari.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the really exciting and important things in the field is the explosion of evidence with respect to good interventions for kids with ASD. And as Peter M., my friend and colleague, mentioned, we have some good interventions for younger kids, and we don't have such great interventions for older kids with ASD. To determine whether an intervention works or not, you have to do something called a true experiment. You have to do a randomized control trial, and we keep very close tabs on what the different randomized control trials there are in the field of ASD. The caller's mentioning something called craniosacral therapy, and up to this point, it hasn't been evaluated in a proper randomized...
Do you think it needs to be?
Well, it depends on where you want to put your money. There isn't a lot of money for research. Doing these randomized trials are expensive. This particular form of therapy doesn't have a great sort of biologic or theoretical rationale. So if it were my money, I'd put my $1,000 into evaluating a different kind of intervention rather than that one.
There's a lot more to be discussed at the symposium. This is just a short window into it, and we so appreciate you previewing this new research with our listeners. Dr. Peter Satmari with University of Toronto, Dr. Peter Monday, UC Davis, the two Peters, two of the speakers tomorrow at the 9th Annual Autism Symposium. It runs from 8 to 5 p.m. on the UNF campus. Go to wolfsonchildrens.org/autism for more. Doctors, thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great.
We'll be right back.
on the next Fresh Air, how addictive drugs were used in Nazi Germany. Soldiers were given methamphetamine to keep them awake during battles. Hitler's doctors gave him oxycodone and cocaine. Some drugs were tested on concentration camp inmates. We talk with Norman Ohler, author of the new book, Blitzed. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
It's easy to listen to WJCT even when you're not near a radio. Just visit WJCTnews.org from your phone or tablet. On our mobile site, you're just one click away from a 24-hour live stream of our programming, and you'll also have easy access to all of the top local news stories. Listen live on WJCT's mobile website, WJCTnews.org. On WJCT's radio reading service at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, it's 3 hours of news, op-eds, and obituaries from your local newspaper. Here's a call we received from someone who listens online.
I'm very happy to tell you that my daughter found the app for the radio reading service on my tablet, and I'm using that, and it's excellent. I enjoy all the programs.
If you're living with blindness and want to hear what's in the paper, go to wjct.org/radio reading, underwritten by Florida Eye Specialists.
Welcome back. Well, it's an organization that began just over a century ago when three female journalists in Washington were not allowed to join the then all-male press corps. Since that humble beginning in 1897, the National League of American Pen Women has grown from the nation's capital, where it started, to branches that have spread all over the country, including one right here in Jacksonville. Their goal, to support creative professional women in the arts. Now, this Friday, in observance of Women's History Month and the League's 120th anniversary, a special event is happening. Local Penn Women President Duncan Sawyer is here now to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And the press corps in Washington has come a long way since 1897, when they tried to join the official organization and the guys wouldn't let them in. So that's how this League of Penn Women began. It was just due to gender bias.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And so they formed in 1897. What was it like in the beginning?
If you think about what women went through in 1897, they were just sort of second-class citizens, and they decided they were not going to be second-class citizens, and they struck out on their own, and they formed the National League of American Pen Women.
So it started with that first chapter in the nation's capital.
Yes.
And then how did it grow and spread to branches nationwide?
Different branches decided, different cities wanted to have branches. There are quite a few very famous women that are in the American Pen Women in the past, and I do know the names of them.
So who are they?
The famous women that were part of it were one of the original women was Vinnie Rehm, Eudora Waltley, Pearl Buck.
Eudora Welty, the author.
Yes.
Pearl Buck. Sure.
Eleanor Roosevelt, Amy Beach, and Carrie Jacobs Bond. And those are just some of the very important names of women that were in the Penn Women.
Now, you yourself, Duncan Sawyer, will be leading a celebration of the 120th anniversary. You are the granddaughter of the late Mary Friels Roseborough, author of two historic novels set in Florida. And so you've followed in your grandmother's footsteps.
Yes, I have.
And by your photography. So
yes.
That is your entry into membership into this group.
Yes, I did that. And I also did archival work. And the Penn Women since then have really expanded all of what they allow you to become a member. If you go on to the website, National League of American Penwomen.org, they will tell you and show you, well, they'll let you know all the different areas that have been expanded, not just writing and the arts, but there's music, poetry, all kinds of areas.
Theater, painting, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the local branch celebrated its 90th anniversary
yes.
last year, so you're mm-hmm. almost to your century mark.
Yes.
That's uh-huh. pretty amazing.
It is. Mm-hmm.
So you're going to recognize all of this mm-hmm. later this week in recognition of Women's History Month. What's going to be happening?
The event will be held at UNF. It'll be in the library. It starts at 5:30 to 7:30. There'll be a panel discussion with three more of our members, and we'll talk about the Penn women and their history and from our members' perspective.
Now, the Penn women began as a way to form their own power base since they were so excluded from the press corps. Now, in this era today, where women have really moved to having seats at the table in all of these fields, it's evolved over the years, hasn't it, this organization, in terms of providing different types of mentorship and support for women fields?
Yes, it has, but it also gives you a very good sense of camaraderie. That is really nice. The women that I interact with, some of the women knew my grandmother, and that makes it very special.
I've actually had the opportunity to visit the headquarters in Washington, D.C., which is this beautiful old historic home. And if you're a member of Penn Women, you can spend the night there.
Yes.
It's like the cheapest, nice room in all of D.C.
Yes.
It's like 80 bucks a night or something like that.
It's on DuPont Circle in Washington, and sort of the headquarters where to be.
You're right.
Have
you stayed there?
No, I have never stayed there.
Well, maybe one day.
Yes.
but in the meantime, people need to come out to the event on the 10th as the local branch celebrates 90 years. The National League celebrates 120 years. Mm-hmm. It's the local and National League of American Penn Women. Duncan Sawyer, kudos. And thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
More to come. We'll be right back.
Social commentary is nothing new for television sitcoms. What is new is this political environment.
Initially, we were scared that, oh God, maybe people are going to run away from it. You know, some of us still feel that way.
I'm Kai Rizdal. When the politics change, but your show stays the same, that is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's a new administration's first 100 days, and the news is flying fast.
Protesters arrived here.
Keystone XL pipeline.
The Affordable Care Act.
New refugee
Obamacare.
Admissions for
all things considered, will be here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
Hello.
This week on Jazz Night in America, we're celebrating the legacy of Miss Betty Carter.
Thank you for coming.
Vocalist Sharonne Wade and friends pay tribute to the late singer.
It feels a lot more personal with Betty Carter. Really personal, like she's your auntie, sister, friend.
That's this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, a look at women who are unstoppable. This region's power women are sharing their unstoppable stories of business success as the women business owners of North Florida get them all together in one place. Event chair Pixie LaRizza is here to tell us more. And a minute ago, we talked about the League of Penn Women. It's Women's History Month, so now we're talking about unstoppable women. Good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. Great to be here.
So this is your signature event. It's called Unstoppable. What's going to be happening?
We're bringing together some women in our community that have said yes to all their opportunities and elevated themselves above and beyond. We're telling stories of women who have succeeded in business through unstoppable and outrageous challenges that they've had. And so it's going to be motivated. It's going to be educational. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of networking, an opportunity for women to connect with each other and celebrate the spirit of women.
Excellent. Now, the keynote speakers are Audrey Moran of Baptist Health and the Jags Chamber and Michelle McManaman.
Correct. Audrey is just such a light whenever we've spoken with her, and she's graciously coming to talk about her experiences, how she said yes to get to where she is today.
What about you, Pixie Larissa? By the way, you have the best name in the world.
Thank you.
Your name is such a reflection of you. You know, you're just full of energy and light, and everybody that meets you, I think, is just instantly charmed. Tell us about your business.
I started in massage therapy 27 years ago when massage wasn't something that was on the tip of everyone's tongue. It wasn't like we massage envy and those type things. So it was really a challenge to break into a new industry. And from there, things have grown. I've taught locally at the local hospitals and wellness centers. I now have an art program that I do, and I have clothing design now. So it's all really amazing.
So you do a lot of things. What advice would you have for a woman that wants to start her own business? And it can be really difficult to get going.
My best advice would be understand the nuances of how to run a business. My background is in bookkeeping for 14 years because I knew I wanted to have my own business. Being able to understand financials, understand how income expenses work and balance sheets and all of those things are really key. And then surround yourself with good people. Get a good attorney. Find out if you need to incorporate. And then rely on your gut instincts. Move forward to what you're passionate about, what you're drawn to, and ask for help.
Yeah, all good advice. And right up until 2017, the data still shows that the majority of new businesses are started by women for a variety of reasons. But sometimes it's because they're still bumping up against a glass ceiling in corporate America, and they decide to just go into business for themselves.
There's that, and I also believe, too, the flexibility of having one's own business affords working moms to be able to take care of their families and to set their own schedules. And there's a lot of remote businesses now that will let you work remotely from home.
Yeah.
And
it's
that's
getting better. Corporations are getting more flexible in allowing for all of those demands. But if you own your own business, on the one hand, you have more flexibility, but on the other hand, you're never off work.
Well, it's a balance. And yeah. There is inertia and no one wants to be totally completely at a standstill. So it's finding how much time do we spend dedicated to business and how important are we that we rejuvenate ourselves so that we can stay dedicated to that business.
Now, women at this event are going to share their unstoppable power stories. What's your unstoppable story?
My unstoppable story, at the age of 11, I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. Because I didn't want to be able to be fired. My mom was a single mom. She had come home and had lost her job. And I thought, I don't ever want somebody to be able to dictate that for me. Mm-hmm. So from then, it was onward and upward.
So you always knew you wanted to paddle your own canoe.
Yes. Didn't know what it was going to be.
Uh-huh.
And was fortunate enough in my late 20s to find out that it was massage therapy that kicked it off.
Wow. And how did they come upon the idea of calling this unstoppable?
I have a creative team of Barbara Tolliver Haskins and Barbara Friedland, who are both past presidents of WBO, and we sat together and brainstormed, and we looked at women's conferences, titles throughout the country and beyond, and a common theme that we saw, or the word unstoppable, came up. And we all felt, because we're all entrepreneurs, that this was going to be a good topic that we could get our head around, and we could share it, and then we could let women tell their unstoppable stories to be more motivating. So that's how it came about.
You are pure motivation every time I see you. And this is going to be lots of fun. Now, this is coming up not this week, but next week on the UNF campus.
Correct. It's Thursday, March 16th. It's from 1 until 5:30. We have a networking reception that we're starting out. Of course, I'm all about food, so it will definitely be food. And we'll start the program at 1:30, and afterwards we'll have additional networking with the speakers as well, and that will include free appetizers and a cash bar. And you can still get tickets at wbonfl.org, or you can, if you have to just show up the day of the event, we won't turn anyone away.
Which is so typical in this town. I'm sure you'll get those. But it's next Thursday at the UNF University Center, Unstoppable by the Women Business Owners of North Florida. Event Chair Pixie Larissa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
That's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. Next on 1A, is America's intelligence community an asset or a liability? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.